Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your reoccurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to a very special edition of Beyond the Darkness. And when I say that, I don't take this term lightly today, Tim. We've been doing the show, Darkness Radio and Beyond the Darkness, for, what, 13 years now?
Yep.
This time of year always rolls around and you and I play the should we or shouldn't we game. Is there anything left to look at or expose in the JFK story? And every few years, something interesting ripples the water and gets our attention, and we've taken a look at it. And we've had some really interesting, fascinating guests over the years that have brought to light different aspects of this story. And this year, you and I were both prepared to just move through it like it didn't happen. Just go on with our natural show. But in the 11th hour, I got an email from a publicist. And Tim, let me just tell you, when I read this information, I was put back on my heels and I thought, all right, if we're going to do it, this may be the last best Kennedy assassination interview we ever do. And I've been looking forward to this. I'm so glad that our guest is joining us for today. We're going to spend today focusing on this case. There will be no theater of the mind today because of the weight of this episode and the context, and due to the fact that it's not really in the paranormal realm, I want to avoid that aspect and just give our guest his due and his opportunity to share his story with us. So, ladies and gentlemen, if you're ready for a ride and a new story, a new angle, and a new aspect to this history, you're in the right place at the right time today. You know, Tim, sharing my birthday on November 22nd with the day of the assassination of one of the most beloved presidents has not been a real fun memory for me growing up, right?
I've always got that
hanging over my head.
Mm-hmm.
And I've watched documentaries, watched the movies, read some books, spoken to some people. And over 13 years, as I said, we've had a chance to speak some really interesting people and some completely crazy people. And we've heard fascinating aspects of the story that haven't always been revealed or have been held back. And here we are, going 55 years since this guy's assassination. What could possibly be left to tell? Well, there are a lot of conspiracy theories surrounding this assassination. And Christopher Fulton, our guest today, his real life story is not one of just those conspiracy theories. Christopher Fulton has come forward for the first time to give the country and the world some answers. Fulton had possession of the closest physical evidence to President Kennedy's fatal head wounds, and he was the first person since Robert Kennedy to listen to JFK's secret Oval Office recordings. He's put out a brand new book, and it's called The Inheritance, Poisoned Fruit of JFK's Assassination, co-authored by his wife, Michelle Fulton. And in this book and in our interview, he's unlocking some of the mysteries that have haunted our nation for the past 55 years. Christopher Fulton, thank you for joining us today on the show.
Thanks, Seth. Thanks for having me on, Dave.
Why now? Why come forward at the 55-year mark? Was there something significant about this time in your life that you decided enough's enough, I need to speak up?
Yes, there are several factors. First of all, I should say, can you hear me okay? Am I coming through all right?
Yes, you're coming through fine.
Oh, okay, all right. So there's many factors involved. I've had a family recently, and I've been very fortunate to gone through some very extreme situations, and one of my outcomes of that is to be on the other side. And it took me quite a while to get through emotionally what I'd been through. But the one of the main things is that President Trump had been asked to release the files on the assassination through the National Archives, and those materials were still controversial even today. And the American public really deserves to know the information in this, and they're not getting the information. The files that were released at the ninth hour, the intelligence services and the FBI had come forward to ask him to hold back material, and even barring that, there's other material that has been removed, and even some that it has to do with my situation involving the evidence. So the American people really aren't getting the full picture of this, and I personally don't believe that that's right, that they deserve to know as much as possible about it. And that's why I decided it was, I really owed it to the American people and to the President Kennedy and Senator Robert Kennedy and John F. Kennedy Jr. and to Evelyn Lincoln, which was President Kennedy's secretary, to come forward now and discuss this openly.
Christopher, if you could tell me, prior to this information coming to you, did you have thoughts regarding the JFK assassination? Was it part of your world? Of course, it's all part of our world, but I mean, was there anything special about this story in connection to you before, you know, this information came into your hands?
Not particularly. I mean, I grew up just outside the district, and my mother was a very interesting person, and she had contact with people, members of the FBI and the Secret Service that had come over for parties and that sort of thing. And my father had been involved with NASA and the Apollo projects and so forth. And it actually worked for a task force for President Kennedy, a small task force. But my interest was just patriotic, just like everybody else on the subject. I didn't really have any specific interest to do any kind of investigative work on it. It just so happened that huge amount of information that was withheld for so many years for reasons and orders on behest of Robert Kennedy fell into my lap, myself and someone named Robert White, after she passed away. And then we had to decide how this was going to be best handled and what to do with it.
How did you come to know Evelyn Kennedy?
Yeah, Evelyn Lincoln.
Or Evelyn Lincoln, I'm sorry, right.
Evelyn Lincoln, Robert White was a friend of mine who lived in Catonsville near Baltimore, and he actually kind of became her kind of surrogate son. They didn't have a family. And she subsequently put her trust into him because she did not want this information to be under the control of any government agency or the White House or anything else. So she decided that it would be an individual with integrity or someone that she felt that she could trust to pass this along and then would determine how this information would come out.
And this information that she sat on, how did she get access to this and it not end up coming out or being taken from her before her death or at the time of the assassination?
It certainly was looked at by the Johnson administration to be secured from her. Bobby Kennedy had withheld information after his brother's assassination, subsequently withheld from the FBI's investigation on it so that he could do his own private investigation into his brother's murder. And subsequently, that information was kept. There was disagreements in the Johnson administration and Robert Kennedy on how and what was going to happen and how this was going to come out. But Bobby Kennedy was pretty much trapped in this we were looking at a situation with a nuke exchange with Russia at the time, and if Bobby Kennedy had given the evidence to the American public, the administration would have taken the position that the evidence was enough that pointed to Cuba and to the Russian connection, that we'd probably go to war, and Russia was ready to was fully expecting an exchange and was ready to do that. So that Bobby Kennedy's position was looking at the numbers of American casualties involved in that, and took it upon himself to work within the government, not to overthrow the Johnson administration, and to do what was best for the country.
When your friend has this information, how does he break to you, "Hey, Christopher, I've got something that needs to be looked at"? Does he, you know, I mean, how does that kind of conversation even come up?
Well, the transfer took place through court. It was his inheritance took place through a court system. So he was the family was notified. I think the National Archives were notified, who didn't step in at that juncture. And so the transfer took place. Once the transfer took place, he was contacted and I was contacted. I had pieces of the of this information that had come through Evelyn Lincoln, and he had the bulk of that. But he was approached by President Reagan involved in this, and I was approached by CSIS, which is the Canadian Intelligence Service, about this, and then we conferred on what was happening and who was approaching us. I had gone and actually made a trip to involved in my business, which was the construction, commercial construction business, and had gone to Moscow involved in that early on, very early on, and looking at the developments with that country. And I was subsequently invited to the Kremlin, where I'd met a man called General Alexander Levitt, who was actually the head of their intelligence services at the time. I wasn't aware of this, but he's actually going to be running for the presidency as well. And he knew about this information and basically was debriefing me in the Kremlin on whether I wanted to release this to the American people through Russia and I wouldn't be censored. Of course, I declined that, said I didn't know where, I didn't want to tell him that I knew anything about it, and left Russia almost immediately. But Reagan wanted this to be very carefully thought about by both of us, because he thought that it was time that this information gets to the American public, but he also didn't want it coming out to a foreign government or in any way that would the American people would lose faith in their government system. So it's a very delicate. It was a very delicate balancing act for both of us, and as it turned out, it didn't turn out very well for either one of us, actually.
Well, now Robert Kennedy had this information. Do you think that his assassination in part was because of the information that he had regarding his brother's death?
His assassination was based on several factors from what I've been told and understand, but one of the majority factors involved in that was he was going to inform the American people once he reached the office, the Oval Office. He'd made a speech, he'd made agreements with Johnson, I'm sorry, prior, that he was going to put this to rest and was not going to bring this up and was going to continue to support the Warren Commission's conclusions. In private, he knew that that was a false falsehood, and that those conclusions were based largely on the fact that the Russian government had put pressure on the Johnson administration to come clean with the American people, to absolve them from any concern of possibly going to war. So the Warren Commission was not so much for the American public as it was to make sure the Russians understood that they weren't being held responsible, and there would be no surprise attack or exchange that would take place.
All right, so we've got, and we're picking up some rustling noise again. I'm not sure if you're hearing that, but just letting you know. So Robert Kennedy plans on releasing this information and blowing the lid off once he takes the Oval Office. Why wait until he gets in that position to do it? I mean, if he wants to make a difference, why not make that difference beforehand. You know, I mean, by coming forward, I would think that would have locked him for the presidency as it was.
That you would think that, but the weight that was put upon him, the day after the assassination, I think within 24 hours, it was pretty well established what had taken place. And Robert Kennedy was essentially his power, who he went from the second most powerful person in the United States, or maybe even, maybe you can even basically surmise it as a co-presidency if you want to go that far. But he went from that position to almost ineffective within a 24-hour period. He was cut off. He had no effective power. The FBI was dealing with the investigation directly, reporting directly to Johnson. Johnson had made sure that he had no power. There was not a car to pick him up to go to work, et cetera, et cetera. So he was left in a very diminished capacity. And then he was faced with the decision of what he was going to do. The Russian government thought that he was going to plan, or the FBI was also concerned that he might overthrow the current Johnson administration and have another coup. Which he decided was not in the interest of the United States, and then he had to look at the loss of the they had looked very closely. Robert Kennedy, along with President Kennedy, had looked at the numbers of Americans that would be lost on a first strike basis in Moscow, and or an exchange with Cuba was the catalyst or the linchpin that was being utilized for that at the time, and decided it was in the best interest to stay pat. Now, as he continued, there were agreements that were put into place, and Robert Kennedy did have to sign an agreement where he was not going to testify in any capacity, and he would be a U.S. senator and stay put. To Robert Kennedy's credit, I can't imagine there was many other decisions he could make that wouldn't have triggered a massive problem and loss of American lives. I think he made the only decision that he could. And then he hoped he would get far enough ahead to take us back to the course that his brother had put us on initially. And when he saw that Vietnam was getting out of hand, and he saw the loss of American life that was continuing, and the American nation was so divided over these issues, he stood up and decided, "I'm going to take the office in '68. That's where I would have been to begin with, and that's where I'm going to do." He went to Johnson and informed him as such. And there was a verbal agreement between the two. Johnson stepped down, would not run against, would not take the nomination for a second term. And Bobby Kennedy was going to run for president. Now, subsequently, he made a speech where he said that he was going to open up the Warren Commission and open up the files at the appropriate time. Well, that was a very important statement, that public statement. And that conferred that he was breaching his agreement that he had made with Johnson. And basically, Bobby Kennedy was very aware of where all the skeletons lay in all this problem, and they weren't going to allow him to get to gain the Oval Office. So to answer your question, yes, it had a lot to do with why Robert Kennedy was not allowed to become president of the United States in 1968. Subsequently, he gave instructions to Evelyn Lincoln and to a White House Secret Service agent who was the head of the Protective Research Section, whose name is Robert Balk. These two people were working very closely with him with this evidence, and they had helped secure this evidence from the Johnson administration during this period. And the instructions were clear: if I don't make it, which he was very aware that he might not make it, if I don't make it, I want this evidence to stay pat and stay secured for the protection of my family and for the children and everything else, so that until such a time later on where somebody can release it, but I want this to be secured and to not be put under classification, so the American people would never be able to review it. So that's what happened after the assassination. And Mr. Balk, who I have spoken with at length about this, and also Evelyn Lincoln, were given those instructions. And to both their credits, they did exactly what they were told to do.
Nixon gets into power, and he plans to release information. Is that part of the history as well? Do you think that's why suddenly his presidency falls into this, you know, disrepair and conspiracy, and everybody starts, you know, blowing whistles and everything? Is it because of his want and desire to come forward?
I believe the way it was explained to me is that President Nixon had a lot of paranoia and was particularly concerned about the Kennedy assassination evidence coming out. My understanding, the way it was, again, told to me, was that President Nixon was somebody that Johnson had approved. They had information on each other, and to secure that, Johnson wanted to make sure that the next president of the United States was not going to blow up his administration at being an illegal administration in any way. And so that, President Nixon was quite paranoid, and that paranoia led to him trying to make sure that no information had come out, was coming out about the Cuba problem and the Kennedy problem and what that all entailed. And therefore, I think part of that was his downfall, yes.
The Inheritance, Poisoned Fruit of JFK's Assassination. Christopher Fulton, our guest, as we examine this case from a completely different angle. And again, Christopher, I appreciate you coming forward to share this, and we're going to get into your story, but I'm just kind of helping right now to push the narrative along, how it's interesting. So many people involved in this behind the scenes met with some interesting fates as well. You know, Reagan, who was all for getting this information out, faced his own assassination attempt. Bill Clinton, right? Wasn't Clinton also trying to spearhead getting this information out and finally get some resolve and truth to this just before the Monica Lewinsky situation broke?
Well, to President Clinton's credit, he had actually pushed personally to continue the Assassination Record Review Board longer than it was supposedly meant to go. So in that regard, yes, he was certainly attempting to continue that process.
So you've got all that going on. Then information gets into the hands of JFK Jr. And, you know, if you don't want to talk about a conspiracy, it sure looks like anybody's life that was touched by this story and knew more than they should or pushed for the truth certainly met with some very disturbing actions in their life, whether it's assassination attempts on their lives, personalities, or perhaps even in giving their own death. Do you believe that JFK Jr.'s death ties into the story as well, or is that just a sad tragedy that continues to follow the Kennedy family?
I'll be very careful how I answer this, Dave. But when John Kennedy Jr. when he died, I was locked up in federal prison at the time, so I can tell you what happened. Before that, when I was involved with him and President Clinton's lawyers and his lawyer, basically he was very interested in pursuing the evidence in his father's case. It wasn't like people perceive that he had no interest and he was fluffing about. Actually, George Magazine was being utilized as a very important political tool that was not being regulated to the point where, he could, if he put the information out, it would be released. It was not going to be censored. So he had built that magazine into an open forum for the American people to see politics and see what was going on. But he was very much interested in his father's assassination and gathering evidence in that and giving the American people the straight information. But when he was going to make that happen, obviously he didn't. He perished.
Again, there you've got just kind of an interesting aspect of this whole story. So once you've got this information and it's turned over and you've had a chance to review it, I mean, what is that like for you? Did you have any idea what it was that you guys were about to take possession of?
It was a progressive thing, I think, for both of us. There was a lot of material, a tremendous amount of material. You're talking about maybe 100,000 documents or so, and a lot of personal correspondence, personal items, Edwin Lincoln's information, inside information, some that was going to be used for the public, some that was private. So there was a tremendous load of material, and subsequently we decided it was of such importance that we were going to do a book on this, and photographs were taken, and we had gotten a very, secured a very good agent in New York, and but all of that got quashed down. The Donald Trump had come on board in 1997, late 97. There was an auction that was taking place in Guernsey's in New York. Robert White had, was going to sell some of this material to get some funding to do some other things with. I was involved in that sale. I was asked to be in that sale. Subsequently, when that took place, it was a catalyst. The Justice Department got involved. A lot of other investigative bodies got involved. The Security Oversight Office got involved to the point where they now declared that Robert White was and I were in possession of national security information. And so subsequently, the whole picture changed quite quickly. Even at one point, the somebody representing the Royal Family of England was involved very briefly. But it was an uncovering process as it went along. It wasn't an instant knowledgeable situation from day one, if that's what you're asking.
All right. You guys are uncovering this, and as you said, you've got information that, you know, Bobby Kennedy had entrusted to Lincoln to protect this information because of how explosive it really was. When you were going through this and you were listening to these tapes, what, you know, I don't know how much of it you're able to give away, but I mean, what were you most shocked by that you were hearing and reading and seeing in this evidence?
You know, what I was most shocked by is I was sitting in a room listening to the President of the United States talk to me one-on-one, and nobody had reviewed this information but Bobby Kennedy. And so I was the first person to listen to this, and it's extremely moving. Here's a very different president, probably from his predecessors, talking about things of great national importance and concern, and he was doing it in ways that were not standard practice. He would make phone calls to the men that were in the silos to see how they were doing, what they were like, what their thoughts were, who's got their finger on the pulse of this, and who's, you know, how are they going to be if it came down to that kind of situation. Talking about working a network of people that he trusted in journalism and in Hollywood and the places that were outside our national security apparatus and getting intel from them, utilizing that so that he could operate in a way that would I don't want to say supersede, but certainly be outside the normal parameters of the intelligence briefings that would come in. He wanted to have a much broader perspective of what was going on and how to handle it properly. And basically the agenda was a peaceful world. I mean, if anything I can say now is that, you know, there were plans on the table, and this has happened since World War II, that we were going to go to an exchange with Russia at some point. It was inevitable. And why the missile gap was heavily in our favor, which wasn't known really publicly at that time, the thing was being pushed, the ideas were being pushed, and this was coming out of the Pentagon and so forth and so on, that we were going to hit Moscow first, that it had to be struck first, and that way the rest of the country would fall very quickly, and we would get out of the squeeze that we'd be in ultimately one way or the other. This exchange was going to happen. So the Kennedy brothers were looking at this, and it was placed in their lap, and they decided, they looked at the numbers of American casualties, even if it was a first strike. I think they were looking at 45 million American dead. And they just said, no, this isn't happening. This is not acceptable, and whatever has to be done to stop this is going to be the main priority. And both brothers essentially lost their lives over this issue. There was a 9-day countdown that was happening at the time that President Kennedy went to Dallas on how this is going to be resolved, and a lot of people, a lot of Americans, I don't think understand that issue. And President Kennedy was going to do things in a way that was not going to allow his brothers that he expected to get into the Oval Office after him to have a worse a more complicated or serious problem off of Cuba than they had already, which would lead to the doors of Russia. And of course, the communications were going outside normal channels with Khrushchev and with Castro as well. As a matter of fact, Castro was being talked to the day that President Kennedy died, and was trying to be allied with the United States and the UN to work together so that they could come to a peaceful resolve. But if that didn't happen, Kennedy had a backup plan to be able to go into Cuba and the CIA and the mafia operations that were being used since World War II would have been cut out of that whole process. That it would have been a military operation strictly, and it would resolve this issue and this buildup of tension between the United States and Russia. I don't think people understand the seriousness of all of that, even if they know about the Cuban Missile Crisis, and they understand what was happening in some of that, but they don't understand that it was a continual problem. And it came to quite a head in November of 1963.
When you're reviewing that audio and you're hearing these voices and you're hearing this compassionate leader talk about what's going on, and, you know, there's a possibility of 30 to 40 million Americans being lost in this. Was there ever a mention of what was an acceptable number? I mean, was there ever any context given to that? Or was it just, no American life was going to be acceptable?
I've seen the documentation from the center that was prepared by the Central Intelligence Agency of the numbers of acceptable losses across the United States, even up to current type of time. I saw these documents in the 2000s. But that is an acceptable thing that is being looked at through our governmental agencies. But the Kennedys took the position that no American life was worth this. Not even he was also concerned about the men that were being lost in Vietnam, and we're gonna stop that. One of the things he said was, "I'm gonna be the least popular president in U.S. history in 1964." Those reasons being the intelligence community in the Pentagon hated it. Hated what he was doing, going around them and subverting their authority and their power on this. But at the same time, he was working for the American people. He was working for the American public and the Constitution of the United States, and that's what he believed in. He understood better than anyone. He was over in Berlin in 1945 and had seen the Russians and how they were ruthless coming into to Berlin and what they had done and how scared or concerned that the American establishment was of the Russians. I mean, basically Vietnam was a planned 10-year operation he was not going to allow that to happen. And it was to show the resolve of the United States, not only to stop the spread of communism in Asia, but to make sure that the Russians understood that we're ruthless, that we'll, men and women, children, doesn't matter what needed to be done. We would show the Russians our resolve, and that would keep this out of an exchange with Russia. So Kennedy didn't believe in that. He didn't think any American life, every American life was important. It wasn't a justifiable situation. It was better to go to the source and get these things resolved from the source. He opened up communications with the Russians and NASA to work together to resolve their differences so that they could have a joint space program, and so that it lessened the chance of an attack or a missile launch that would be done or a competition, as it were, between the two powers. And he very much felt the international diplomatic relations were crucial. And that, especially given that this new world that we were living in, where we had weapons of mass destruction of such a magnitude, right, that there would be no winners. There'd be no winners. If an exchange takes place, we all lose. And so these people that he deemed, and I can name names if you'd like, but that's beside the point, that they were insane with power and drunk with it. Yes, of these other people on the other side, I can see their point and their position. They were coming from a different type of establishment from World War II, and they assumed that this was the right course for America's survival. But Kennedy came from a different point of view and said, no, this, I understand where you're coming from, but that's old thinking, and we have to start thinking in a different way. And that's where a lot of the conflict had arisen, between the intelligence and the Pentagon and the Kennedy administration. And so there was a lot of division there that was operating secretly. It was far from the American public's eye. It was a national security concern then, and it would be today as well. But the Kennedys were operating always. Even I've heard his private conversations. I know what the man said. I know who he was talking to. I know what he was discussing. He was operating in the best interest of the American people. And I think that's very, very important, because the people that have come after, especially immediately after the Johnson administration, were put into power for a reason. Nixon was put into power for a reason, and onward it went. I mean, Ford was also part of the investigation of the Warren Commission, was given his nod because of what he said in the Warren Commission. It goes on and on. And we're just going down a path of more and more problems. The way it was explained to me is if you've got a piece of land called Manhattan and something had happened illegally, there was an illegal transfer of land or something that had been a mistake or someone had made an error, and you go back and you go through a court system and you say, listen, this can be proved, and every high-rise that's up here, nobody owns this property. Nobody wants that. Nobody wants to reverse the engines and say that every law that's been passed or all the government decisions that have been made, and a lot of them have been good, are no longer valid. That's not on the table. So the Justice Department has been given authority to say there's going to be no chasing of any prosecutions in this case. We're not going to do anything in regard to this, whether there's new evidence tendered or not. And the only way that would happen is if a Kennedy family member pushed it, and it would be looked at through a Texas state law, which is still open to the murder down there. John F. Kennedy Jr. was very much, like I said, very much interested in the evidence that I possessed. I'd like people to read the book so they can get the information through the book about that. But we had discussed at length some of the things that he thought. And, he felt that the American people felt that it was his responsibility in a lot of ways to resolve this problem. But I don't want to talk about that specifically.
Why don't we do this? We're up against a break. We'll come back. In reviewing the information, did Christopher Fulton feel like Kennedy was aware that this assassination might be forthcoming, that he might not make it out? We'll talk about that and talk about Christopher's story when we return. You're listening to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.
Beyond the Darkness.
Welcome back to the show. Beyond the Darkness is on the air. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, Tim Dennis. Our guest today, Christopher Fulton, the new book, The Inheritance, Poisoned Fruit of JFK's Assassination. The book is out and available November 22nd. So make sure you go order it. We'll have a link up to that book on today's show, so it's easier for you to find. But you definitely need to get this book. Tim, you were talking to me off air. You had a couple of great points I want to make sure we cover. And as I said, I want to get into... in reviewing the evidence and the information that you were given, did Kennedy have any kind of glimpse or idea that his death was imminent, or that there was something going on? But before we launch into that, Tim, what point did you want to jump into with Christopher?
Well, earlier, Christopher, you had made the point that in Cuba, the government had used the mafia, and that's well known, well established. In conspiracy theory, It's been established, I guess, in conspiracy theory, it's been established, or the point is brought up specifically about Santo Trafficante and how he had a beef with the Kennedys, and that Joe Kennedy had this relationship with the Southern Mafia. And then later on, Trafficante really had a problem with the Kennedys, and the fact that Robert Kennedy specifically wanted to shut down organized crime. And it's brought up in a lot of conspiracy theory circles that Trafficante really had a problem with John F. Kennedy and Robert Kennedy. And ultimately, in conspiracy theory circles, they point at Santo Trafficante as the one who ultimately set up the assassination in Dallas. And they think that it might have been his triggermen who pulled the trigger in Dallas. I guess I take the long way around in this question by asking you, in your findings, do the mafia have anything to do with the assassination of JFK, do they end up coming around in this scenario?
I'm sorry, I cut you off.
No, I was just finishing the thought. Do they end up coming around in this scenario at all?
Well, the mafia, it was explained to me that they were utilized in World War II and had come aboard on that aspect that they were intertwined with the United States government intelligence services, and they were being utilized during the war to win the war, and then after the war they stayed on in a capacity that was being utilized for what was necessary or what they were good at. The President Kennedy, or Senator Kennedy, as he's being running for election in 1960, they'd offered the vice presidency to Lyndon Johnson, pretty much almost as an honorary, a note of some sort. But Johnson was fully aware of the fact that Kennedy had Addison's disease, and probably the statistics on him is he wouldn't live past 62. John F. Kennedy himself knew that that may be the case, and certainly was taking not only one doctor's information, but another's doctor's information to keep himself going, so for the American public, so that he can continue and doing what he was doing. Jack Kennedy thought her husband was a very important person making a difference in the world, and I believe she was right. Johnson was brought on board. Johnson did come on board, and Hoover had told Kennedy in no uncertain terms that if Johnson wasn't on board on the ticket, that it would all end right there. There would be no going forward. Now, the way it was explained to me is Lyndon Johnson came on board to protect the interests, a lot of the interests of the mafia side. And maybe it's true, and this is speculation on my point, that the Kennedys, especially Robert Kennedy, had overzealously pursued the mafia prosecutions in retaliation to balance that off against the Johnson's position. But there's no doubt that the mafia connections there. But someone like, to answer your question, Mr. Trafficante, who I certainly don't know him and never met him, but I don't believe he would have the power that it would take to assassinate a sitting president and walk away from the situation. You know, you have to look at Lyndon Johnson, who was the sitting president, who made decisions as they were happening on that day to ensure President Kennedy's assassination took place fully rather than an attempted assassination. I might have to describe that better if you want me to.
Sure, yeah. Let me ask you this before you describe that. Do you then feel that it was towards the end of Santo Trafficante's life, and I believe it was while he was in prison, he was kind of half out of his mind. He was starting to get a bit of dementia, and in that, I believe he said something to the effect of he made a half of a deathbed confession where he sort of admitted that he took out or had Kennedy taken out, JFK taken out. Do you contribute that to a man who's suffering with dementia, or do you contribute that to a guy who's maybe boasting or trying to make a name for himself, or do you believe that that's actually a true confession?
I would contribute that to the fact that, nothing happens by chance, and but generally it's the people that are in the service one way or the other, whether I guess it's the mafia or the intelligence services, they take orders, and certainly Johnson was part of the part of that world, so they're having a hand in all of this. I have no doubt that that's absolutely correct, that they did have a hand in this and they were utilized as part of this process. And to answer the other thing you had brought up earlier, maybe I can address it now. President Kennedy was very aware of the fact that he was in a vulnerable position. I'd read Jackie Kennedy's wills starting from 1962. She had made quite a few of them, and she was very, very concerned about an assassination even in 62. But the assassination that they figured was coming, or what their understanding of it, was it was going to be a false flag attempt to push him into a position with the American public to invade Cuba. So on November 22nd, President Kennedy was notified that the attempt, if there was going to be an attempt on that day, was called off, and he thought his information was good. The information that had come to him before had been good. And supposedly, I guess it was called off, and it was called back on very at the last minute. He had made sure that Jackie had worn that pink Chanel outfit to make sure that she was a very visible person in that limousine, not to be hit. But President Kennedy was a very brave soul, and he figured that he could die at any time. Evelyn Lincoln had actually warned President Kennedy before he went to Dallas. It told him verbally that there is a talk that you're going to be shot at in Dallas. That that came from the Secret Service that her husband had overheard in Washington. This was Johnson's Secret Service now. So Kennedy said, "I understand," and that the said, "Well, if they can get me anywhere, they can get me in church, they can get me anywhere," and was very brave about all of that. What he was doing and what he was involved with wasn't matters of a simplicity of whether a state was getting funding for a project or something. We were talking about whether the world was going to continue in a way where we all survived. We didn't. So in that capacity, he took it upon himself that it was more important than any aspect of his life. We all were benefited by that by that ability or by that person that came at the right time. If Nixon had been in office at that time, I believe it would have gone very differently.
All right, man, it's like a sip from a fire hose as we examine all the different aspects of this case. And here you are, you get this information in the mid-90s from the estate of Evelyn Lincoln, and your story starts to build from here. And I guess I want people to read the book because it's important to hear your story and the full story. And in this case, I know we're not going to do the full story justice in a 90-minute interview, but I want to make sure we touch on the fact of how this impacted you. You get this information and everybody's aware of it. I mean, you're actually in touch with presidents and other people that know about this, and sons of presidents, and where does Reagan this suddenly?
Reagan had actually stated that we know more about this than the president of the United States, which I thought was a very interesting comment. You know,
how do you think
I was asked recently. Go ahead. Uh-huh. I'm sorry.
No, please go ahead. You were asked recently.
I was asked recently. I mean, when I'm in the writing of this at the beginning of this process to go, if I would be willing to go in and to Washington to have a private meeting with Mike Pompeo, who was the CIA director at the time under Trump, and brief him on this. And I said, no, I don't think at this time I want to do that. Yeah, I mean, there are certainly interested parties in all of this because, like I said, the information, most of the information, the American public has no clue about, and there's certainly been a lot of good research done on this, and a lot of good people have brought a lot of information to light. But you know, this stuff had come directly from the Oval Office and directly from Robert Kennedy and what his intentions were, and so forth and so on. So I think it's kind of important. I know that Robert Kennedy's widow is holding on very tightly to his private papers, even to this day, which involved the Cuban Missile Crisis and what happened after the assassination. And there is some infighting, from what I understand, between the factions of the Kennedy family on how they want to deal with this. So I have to be somewhat careful in that regard as well. I certainly want to respect the privacy of the family, but at the same time, I think there are issues here that are of national and world importance that the American people need to know.
Why is it? I mean, again, I know that the Kennedy family has been through a lot, but, you know, this was a position that they put themselves into. This was something that they chose to be involved in. And at this point, the security and aligning history seems more important than, you know, than protecting one family's legacy. Why not just come forward with this information and expose it for what it really is?
Well, there's the balancing act. I mean, the Kennedy family has sacrificed, and John had mentioned this, you know, their sacrifice has been very severe in this regard. So I can only assume that they, you know, whatever their connections or concerns are, or everything else for the rest of their family, that they don't want to continue that process of loss. So I have to respect that, but at the same time, I'm walking a kind of a line of what I think the American people need to know. And for example, somebody I knew, the Justice Department was questioning me on the lines of the recordings that I had and so forth, and they were trying to say, who gives me the right to give out or to put out non-secured national security information from the White House? I said, look, I haven't released any of that, but some of the information that we were going to address was the memoirs of President Kennedy, which he expected everybody to hear. This is not something that I was going to put out there without a review of somebody necessarily. But at the same time, the Justice Department wanted to know everything. What was the evidence that I had? Who was involved? Who was I possibly working for? What was the angle? Who had been exposed? What was the purpose of this? Was there going to be a case opened up in Texas? And was that a plan? Which there was no plan for that. Nobody had ever discussed that on the table. But they were very concerned. And like I said, they had given me what's called a blanket immunity for testimony. And this testimony was in front of the Justice Department and the intelligence services. And this blanket immunity basically covered myself and my family from prosecution for anything, which if they had known me to be a terrorist or a mass murderer or something, that was all covered under their blanket immunity for gaining information about this subject, which is amazing to me considering this all of these things took place back in the 1960s. But again, it comes down to the fact when you start, and President Reagan tried to explain this, as you unravel this, the democratic process and the trust between the people of the United States and the governments that's there to represent them, and the statements of facts that have been put out by the United States government are in contradiction. So therefore, it becomes a concern of how it's handled and who's handling it.
All right. I understand that aspect of this as well. Man, it's a thin line, right? Because there's the need to know, and the world should, and Americans should know what has taken place in the past. And the fact is, you know, that it's still covered up, and that there's probably still very much a shadow government running things and keeping this in play. Don't you feel that kind of needs full confirmation at this point? Our country and our world right now seems to be a little bit out of control. Is it time that something happens and people step up and we as Americans try to take our country back into the hands of the people, as opposed to, you know, sides that don't really seem to worry about the people more than they worry about themselves?
The national security card has been overplayed. And that's something that President Kennedy was concerned about even in the 60s, that would take place. And, of course, a lot of things that he was discussing, it's eerie, because as he's talking about it, you realize we're in it. We're living it. So it's just as current and important as when he said it as it is now. But I can tell you from experience some of the important things that the American people should have seen that Robert White was in possession of. He was forced to sign agreements with the Justice Department and the Kennedy family. These agreements are private and secret. And these items were confiscated from him and placed into the office of where they security oversight office, that they call it. And what they do is they classify things on whatever level they have to be classified. And the materials that came from him, some of these are really important in identifying what happened during the assassination, have been classified, and the American people are not going to see them. So I think that's important to the National Archives, if you want to do your homework, or somebody wants to do the research specifically in Evelyn Lincoln and to Robert White's depositions that were done that are available that can be seen. I think it's important that the American people know that they're not being given the information, that's being withheld.
All right, talk to me about the fact here. They're offering you deals. They're trying to give you some immunity. You ended up doing prison time and not cushy prison time. You were cycled through some of the gauntlets of the worst prisons the country has to offer. You know, where do things jump the track for you? You know, from having this information to, you know, people wanting you to testify, to people wanting you to share this information or come forward, to suddenly you're in prison. How did this all break down?
Well, subsequently, my life was pretty much like anybody else's in a lot of ways. But but when this stuff began to break, the government isn't really concerned, it didn't seem to me, with what you know or what you have, and unless it becomes a concern where it becomes too public, or that you're in a position where it goes to court. Now that changes the game for them. So for me, I went from living my life to being pulled in. There was a subpoena issued for Robert White to testify, okay, before the Assassination Records Review Board. That subpoena was issued by Frank Hunger, which is the Attorney General of the Justice Department. That subpoena was very all-encompassing. It was a very broad document. It was a very it was one of those documents that included me and pulled me into it. And under law, I was supposed to be testifying and pulled to testify in front of the board, the Assassination Records Review Board. They took a position with me because of the evidence that I had was so volatile, I guess, that I wasn't going to be allowed to testify in front of the board, that they were going to, you know, issue a secured warrant and indictment under seal, and that I was going to, I wasn't even going to be notified or contacted in any way about it. I was just going to be brought in. And they wanted to break me and show me their resolve. And when I was put through some things, it's reserved for the, I was hand in hand with the biggest terrorists in the world or in the country, and mass murderers and all these other people. And I was treated no differently than they were. My charges that they brought me in on were from 6 years prior to that time. I had signed a federal loan guarantee, which I didn't understand that at the time, but it was a guarantee with a bank. And I put my income statement in the United States, and it was not correct. So by signing that, I signed a federal form that was not correct, fraudulent, as they said. So they were able to pull me under a tax of failure to evade reporting requirements for the United States for the IRS. So anyway, they pulled me in under that, which happened, 6 years prior to this thing happening, and under the blanket of a national security ticket, and all very quiet, and broke my resolve the best they could. They had me on aircraft chained up for a month at a time every day. I was all over the country chained up at 10,000 feet. We'd go up to 10,000 feet. We'd cruise. We'd come back down, processed in and out of military bases, and then into federal facilities that night, and then back out onto federal aircraft again. And then I was in some of the most hellacious prisons that I didn't know existed on U.S. soil under maximum security conditions. And I asked the prosecutor why they put me through some of that, and they said, "Well, if we really didn't like you, it'd have been a year of that to break you, but we decided to go short on you." So then they put me into another facility, which was pretty horrific, and then I watched people get lethal injections and die in that facility. We didn't know what time it was. We didn't see outside. It was pretty extreme. And so then, after about almost a year of that, they had gone, to threaten my family's position. And I said, "Okay, well, let's negotiate this. This I'll come to the table. I'll do whatever you want me to do." And that's when the agreements were signed. And subsequently, I was looking at a 50-year prison sentence for this, which is pretty extreme. But the feds were pretty heavy-handed. So the 50 years. So when I signed the agreements with the Justice Department, I did my interrogations. Under the threat of perjury, if I had perjured myself, the FBI would have notified the Justice Department. I would have been I'd still be in prison now. So I told them all the information very truthfully, signed agreements with them. I went before the federal judge in the Fourth Circuit in Maryland, and they said, "Okay, well, you understand that if this agreement can be thrown out by me, I can give you 50 years right now." I said, "Yes, I understand that." It was a gag order that they wanted me not to speak. I didn't speak. the judge took a lot of things into account, and then I got sentenced to much less time than I was being pushed to begin with. So I was fortunate in that, and I was able to get through the system. But the it was an eye-opening experience and sort of my own personal war over this information.
The Inheritance, Poison Fruit of JFK's Assassination. That's the book we're talking about. We're speaking with Christopher Fulton, the author of this book. While you're twisting and doing time for this, I'm just curious. I mean, are you trying to figure out ways to cut deals, to get out, to release information? Where exactly are you at in all of this?
Well, I mean, the federal system does a very good job at keeping you locked away on you know, what's called a Federal Reserve, and what stays there, what goes on there is regulated to a large extent. So basically, I was just trying to get through my time. But as I was going through this process, it's very interesting. Initially, the judge involved, who had actually helped me, and there was also a U.S. senator that helped me when I got out. I was sent to a place called Loretto, which is kind of an exclusive place, a very small federal facility, just a camp, after my sentencing in Pennsylvania. And that place is kind of reserved. They have drug offenses there, but people that have, you know, are movie star families or CIA or White House people and that sort of thing. And I met a lawyer there who was had worked with the agency and was on the inside of a lot of tracks. It's amazing how much information goes through attorneys, because attorneys are utilized where they cannot be put on the stand. And so these guys have given a lot of information. But barring that fact, we learned to trust each other, and he was able to give me a lot of insight as to what was going on in my case legally, and the attorneys that were involved in my case, and what the agenda was probably going to be, and all that sort of thing. And I met some other people along the way. So including someone that was an older gentleman that had spent most of his career in Russia in the embassy, and had worked his whole life only to wind up in federal prison. That was his kind of reward at the end of the day for a lifetime of service over there. And he had shown and shared with me some of the Russian side of things through his court case. He was able to keep some of his documentation with the agency, and I was looking at, he shared that, some of that with me. So I did learn some things through that process. It's amazing that they put these people in the same basket in these different places. But to answer your question, I was not, there was no way for me to pursue any information to the American public while I was doing time.
Yeah, I just didn't know if there was any leverage you had with the information. Why do you think, having access to all of the information you have and how secretive they've wanted to keep this, why do you think, Christopher, that you're still alive?
The it's really interesting. The stuff that transferred to us, that came through us, I was initially contacted, like I said, by CSIS. Here's the Canadian Intelligence Services contacting me about this, telling me what I have. But it's amazing how nobody really knew what Evelyn Lincoln had kept. The stuff had been so covertly operated that Bobby had cleverly operated as an attorney during that period, and had made sure that this evidence stayed protected from the FBI and the Johnson administration. But most of the people had no idea what was involved. It wasn't until they kind of caught up on the investigation till they realized what we were in possession of. They didn't even understand it all. So by that time, I've been told that it's highly likely that I'm still here because I went to federal prison. The federal prison saved my life because it put me in a situation where, you know, I wasn't out there roaming about talking to CNN. I was out there, and of course CNN wanted to talk to me. There was a point there in New York where everybody wanted to interview me, and I kept my mouth shut. And again, that probably helped me. But I'd gone to prison, and there was no access. They had control, so that probably saved my life. To answer your question,
so much information, so much of what you know, was held secret for so long. You are both given information. You've looked at this. You see what's going on, and what took place at that time. what, you know, and again, I want people to read it to get the full breadth of the story and the information that you give. But, in, you know, even in the press releases, it talks about the fact that here you are with information that really only you and RFK had and had access to.
That's right. And that's why the Secret Service, when Admiral Lincoln had asked me to contact this member of the Secret Service, Robert Balch, and this man is an incredible gentleman. I mean, he's been involved in presidents and protection and on the inside of things. I'm trying to remember. I think it's since Roosevelt. But geez, he was really an American patriot and didn't even share the information that he gave with me to his own family. He cooperated and opened up to me because he thought that, he assumed Evelyn Lincoln she'd given me the blessing, and therefore I was working for the family and gathering information for the family specific. And, of course, I was not authorized by the family, but he was inclined to discuss this with me and wanted to unload this. Some of the things that he'd held close to his vest for so long, and it hurt him for so long. He said after Bobby Kennedy's assassination, he just didn't have the heart in it anymore. He couldn't go on. He had told me that he was been ruled by law his whole life and was very, very impressed by John F. Kennedy, as my father was, and said that he really appreciated what he was trying to do, and that when his assassination took place, his allegiance went to Bobby Kennedy and not to the promotion that he was going to be given to be part of the cover-up. He worked with Bobby Kennedy in connection with him. And when Bobby Kennedy wasn't able to reach the White House, he said his heart just wasn't in it anymore. He went in with Nixon, or he went in for a short time after that, and just left the service altogether.
The evidence that you were able to see regarding the head wound for Kennedy, can you give us any insights on that without completely revealing the hand of your book and you know, things that you still have to keep undercover?
The evidence that I had was the closest physical evidence, other than for the president's body himself, to the head wound that he received. The evidence wasn't supposed to be there. The Secret Service was not aware that the evidence was in the car. The evidence was subsequently left behind at Parkland Hospital. They didn't believe it when they got the initial report that that this was a hoax or something, because they had accounted for everything. But this was the only piece of evidence that fell outside what had gone back to Washington within 24 hours of the assassination. Bobby Kennedy made sure that it was picked up specific by Mr. Balch. He went from Washington to pick it up, and it was kept by him to run his own forensic evidence on, and kept as a way to determine what was involved and what had actually happened, and maybe who were the players involved in this conspiracy, which of course it certainly was. The Bobby Kennedy used that evidence as a power tool, as a playing card, as it were. And to his credit, his intention was to bring that out to the American public when he reached the White House. But I understand his position was extremely difficult, and what he was doing was in the best interest of the American people. In a different scenario, what you brought up earlier may have been right. If he had said no, the American public is not my primary concern. I'm going to share this and come right out with it. In consequence, it may have shared his life and spared his life. But the outcome could have been dramatic, and it wasn't worth the risk. So in regard to this, not only was factions of our own government involved in making sure that the conclusions fit the bill, but it was Robert Kennedy himself that was in had to be in collusion with this. It was not something that he could have done without great detriment to, I'm sure, but I can't think of any other way he could have handled it. And that is why that the investigation of this thing is so difficult, so damn difficult, because you're looking at it from both sides being in cooperation at the same time to have a conclusion that's in the best interest of the country. So as you're trying to find out the specifics of this, it becomes almost an impossibility. There's no side that's able to have the power to dig it out. And that's why this thing is left unattended for so long, and the American people, have gotten it, and I certainly feel it, that they've got it into their psyche that they've been lied to and not been told the truth, and therefore there's been a disenchantment with the government ever since, and they certainly have the right to feel that way because that's the truth. But I think if we can come clean on some of this and not look backward, necessarily trying to lynch people or to do whatever, but just to say, look, this is what happened and this is why it happened. And so we understand history more clearly. We can have a better ability to maybe move forward and to make better decisions on things that are happening now.
Do you believe that in the information that you had and were able to review in its entirety, do you believe you know who killed Kennedy, who was behind it, and why? Or were you still only a witness to an aspect of the story, a small segment of it?
I have a small segment of it that I can only speak about that intelligently, but the small segment does give you the picture of what happened. It does show you what was taking place, and enough information that the public can understand the issues that were involved. As far as the specific people that were pulling a trigger on a weapon, I'm certainly not going to make any light of that. That's certainly very important, but at the same time, it's like anyone who goes to war or anything else, you're given an order and that's what you do. But I think the real more serious issues for us right now are the issues that we have for the country, where we're going and who we are as Americans and how we're going to define ourselves. And I think it's important that we look at the at this fundamental starting point to get the information and the facts to the public so that we can move forward in a much more clear picture.
Can you tell us, in your estimation, was at least one of the trigger men or one of the people was Lee Harvey Oswald?
Lee Harvey Oswald was involved. He wasn't involved as people know it, him to be involved. And I think it's important to look at Lee Harvey Oswald. He was a very intelligent and important person in history, and the history books have it all wrong. And that needs to be looked at with clarity. Mr. Balk was very specific about that. And
we had Judith Very Baker on our show a handful of years ago discussing this case. And in her story, she was very definitive in the fact that he was an American hero and that he was doing things that he had to do behind the scenes. And it was when he got wind of the assassination coming towards Kennedy, when he alerted the officials that he thought should know, he realized he knew more than he should have, and that put him now in the crosshairs. Do you think that what you know of the story corroborates her estimation that he was a patsy and that it was his knowledge that maybe got him in trouble and got this case hung on him?
Yeah, I would agree with that. Lee Harvey Oswald was put in a multiple facets of positions, and that's why he was being utilized. He had touched the corners of many different things that were happening. I think he wanted to matter in the world, and in the end, he mattered in a way that history wrote him the wrong way. But I think that he was very much interested in trying to do what was in the best interest of the United States, and but that was not set up that way. A lot of the information that are in the files that you read about Lee Harvey Oswald was planted there for specific purpose. So when you're looking at a piece of government evidence on Lee Harvey Oswald, that's not necessarily the correct information. What you're seeing is something that was put there for purpose for his ongoing operations within Cuba and then ultimately Russia. So you're not getting a correct picture of Lee Harvey Oswald.
So we're getting what was placed into his files so that if anybody else received or got access to his files, they would think that he was the enemy, that he was part of the bad guy. He was part of
that
this
was
whole
the
thing.
Idea. That was the idea. That was the idea. Yes.
Fascinating. Very, very fascinating. Strange. I appreciate you coming forward on this, and I know there's so much more to cover in the book. When you've got a few minutes left here with us, what would you like to address to the listeners around the world that are tuning in right now? What would you like to give them as something to take away from all of this?
Well, what I'd like to say is the information that I came into possession of and had seen and been exposed to, and the secrets and the truths don't just belong to Bobby Kennedy. That's not just his mantle or Evelyn Lincoln's or Robert Balch's or John F. Kennedy Jr.'s responsibility, or even Robert White's or mine. They belong to the country, and they belong to all of us. So that's what I'm trying to do. I'm obligated to share that and do the best I can in that regard, and hope that it's a positive change, hope it affects things in a positive way.
Do you think that there's any chance that the information that you came into contact with might be misinformation as well? Might be information that was meant to lead people down the wrong path and continue that narrative so that we never truly find the truth?
Nothing would lead me to that conclusion, because I'm looking at things that came directly from, you know, the desk of Bobby Kennedy, or from the desk of the president, or from Evelyn Lincoln specific. These are the people that were involved firsthand of what was happening, and this stuff was held onto very tightly until this, you know, till we came across it for purpose, and the purpose fits perfectly in the scenario of what I was explained to me. So it's a complicated. It was a very complicated bunch of issues that knowing one piece of the puzzle doesn't necessarily give you the full access. But if you look at it as an overall picture, decisions were made and in the best truth for the American public for us to survive and continue on and so forth and so on. Again, you're dealing with global issues here that are of great importance, and these decisions were made at a time where the world was very different. But again, what I think is extremely important is if you're exposed to it and you look at it, where we were at that time, the what was discussed and how these decisions were made and where we were going. I think if John F. Kennedy had continued and Robert Kennedy had continued following him, that the world would be a very different place. So we would be looking at a very different scenario than we're looking at now. I think the nightmare situations they were looking at in 1963 have manifested out of control and have been utilized for bad purpose. And we've gone down a very long road of mistakes and it led us to this point. And I think we need to pick those pieces up and start to fix the problem from this point.
I appreciate the time, the coming forward with this story at this point in your life. And I hope that this does shake some things up and gets people to reevaluate where we stand. Do you think in your estimation, do you think, as much as we all want the truth, you know, kind of in the immortal words of Jack Nicholson from A Few Good Men, can we handle the truth? Although we should maybe know it, it's something that should be told. Is it something that we're ready for?
Well, there's a lot of people in power that think we aren't willing to do that. But if you forget the people you're protecting, if you forget the reason why the government exists, if you forget why the Constitution was written and it's still valid today, you're forgetting the very reason that these entities are in effect, that they're in effect for the protection and the betterment of the American people. And when you look at a U.S. passport, and the U.S. passport says this bearer deserves the protection of the government of the United States, and I believe that goes as far as the truth as the United States as well. You shouldn't hide behind a national security the ticket for everything you do. Obviously, there's need for national security and on multiple levels and on things that are happening, but not you're looking at something that occurred in the 1960s. Why would you need to continue that process? Well, they're continuing that process because so much mud has been built on this foundation of a lie, and multiple lies, because we're not able to handle the facts of the situation. If you want to stay in a elementary school or a high school situation and never progress past that point, then I encourage that we not look at these facts. But if you want to look at them intelligently and discuss them openly and take them on, then we can progress onto a further level, and we can mature in that and go to a different place in this country. We can be more united in purpose and be more involved in the decision making process. It's not left up to officials that are not held accountable for what they're doing.
There's over, I think, 5,000, maybe even higher, books that have been written about the JFK assassination and the story surrounding it before, during, and after. What sets your book apart? If people pick up The Inheritance, Poisoned Fruit of JFK's Assassination, what are people going to get from your story? Which, this book is your story and your aspect of this. What are they going to get that's new, that will give them insights that they have never had before?
Well, that's what the Russian government had put to me. They said, well, you know, there's been so many books, and they quoted a number, and we look at everything just like your government looks at everything. And he says, well, you guys have been given access to information now that is documented. What are you going to do with it? What's your intent? What's your purpose? And I didn't know how to answer that question then, but my answer probably now would be to make the world a safer, a better place for me and my kids and your kids and everybody that's in the same boat. The more educated that we are, the more informed we are, I believe in the American people, and I think they'll make better decisions based on that information.
So you do believe, aside from hearing your tale and all of the things that you had to deal with regarding this, you do believe that they're going to walk away with information that they were unaware of before? They're going to get a keen feel for a different aspect of this story?
There's little doubt in my mind from the fact that the people that were questioning me, or the people that had talked with me about this subject, or who I run into and talk about as an average American citizen may or may not know, yes. I would say that's definitively yes, that you would be picking up information that's important as an American citizen to know how this transpired and what was happening behind the scenes and who we are now and why. I think, under a covert system or covert operations, I've been to Russia, I've seen how that operates. You can mask and hide a lot of things, and the people that are the losers are the people of the country, because we're the ones that are really going to pay the price, aren't we, one way or the other. We're going to pay the price for decisions that are being made, whether we have a nuke detonation that occurs on American soil and that's being utilized for purpose, or whatever else that comes down the road. We're the ones that are going to be the pawns in that, and we need to be take some responsibility and know the facts and know the truth of things. And I think it should be an open forum and an open discussion about it.
Right.
Everybody can have their specific filters, and my relatives have fought for that right, and I think that's a good thing in a democracy. And a democracy is the best form of government that's existed, as far as I know, so far. So. In that regard, if we're going to be an America that we believe in based on the Constitution, I think we need to move forward in that direction with resolve, and not to leave it up to people to interpret it for us.
At the height of your success in commercial construction, you were extradited, sent to the U.S. Because you were in Canada, sent to the U.S. federal prison for your possession of this physical evidence in JFK's assassination. Your life was turned upside down. Do you regret now ever taking possession of that information? Are you glad that that did come into your hands, so that you know that at some point you've done your part to bring, or at least try to bring, some of this to light in the public's eye?
When I have every other day, when I have a waking dream or a nightmare of the occurrence of an issue that I'd rather forget about, I curse the information, but at the same time, it must have come this way for purpose, and I feel responsibility about that. And life happens as it happens, and when something happens, and you see that it's an important part for you to step up, that's when your character comes into play. And I'm the one who shaves my face in the mirror, and I want to make sure that I feel good about that when I do that. So, yes, I think it was important for me to talk about this time and to bring it forward. If it had come out, if this stuff had come out through the National Archives and been open for the American public to see, I wouldn't have written this book. But the fact the of book, the matter is, it's not. Go ahead.
The book is 528 pages long. You go quite in depth on quite a bit of this. Leave us with one juicy morsel, one thing that people can really sink their teeth into, one secret that has yet to be revealed.
Wow.
528 pages. There's got to be one you can throw out there.
When you say secret to be revealed, give me a context.
In the book, what you've put together, the story that you've, the narrative that you've put together for this entire scenario that you lived through, that you reviewed, that you held in your own hands, that you saw, there were secrets there that have not been revealed to the general public.
Well, maybe an overview, the best I could say is that there was an attempt to bring this forward in 1998. There was a consensus of sorts to bring this information forward, and there was an investigation done and a suppression that involved the Justice Department and the American government at a time when you figured this wasn't still a current ongoing situation. So as far as that's concerned, I could say that's part of what the book is talking about and revealing. It's revealing that this is an ongoing concern for the American government and for the American people, and that they are still not willing, after all these years, to let the American people know or have access to the information. And that's what I'm trying to bring to light, is that this isn't a situation that just happened in 63. Or in 1968, when Bobby Kennedy was taken from us, or Robert Kennedy, I should say more respectfully, that was taken from us, no, this is a still ongoing process, and you need to be made aware of that. You need to have your eyes opened about what's continuing to this day.
Christopher, I have one question for you here, in that, you know, you say that, and this has been the thing that we keep hearing throughout the years, and you've brought it up throughout the interview, in that this information is sensitive, and we keep getting the national security card thrown at us year after year after year. And when it comes to the time when this redacted information is about to be unredacted, and we're about to get the final information given to us, it's taken off the table. And recently with President Trump, it was taken off the table once again. And tell me, what is the absolute worst thing that could happen to us as a society if we were to find out the truth? What is the fear that the government has? What is the worst thing that could happen to us as a society in their eyes? What would happen to us if we found out the absolute truth?
If you look at the city of Washington, D.C., and you look at the monuments there, I grew up there, those monuments were built for purpose. They're built to establish a power base and a respect for the government of the United States, for the people of the United States, and for the world. So with that, if the information that has come out from the United States government or an illegal administration was such that the American people lost faith in the system that they were supposed to entrust the country with and their families with, the loss of power, the loss of the ability to control would be the number one, from what I understand. And that's... Also, you've got collateral damage of innocent people, or not innocent people, but people that are good people in the intelligence communities and other things that could be affected negatively, and all these other sorts of problems. But the real tragedy of this, and the scary part of this, is that if you never tell your children the truth about anything, they're never going to grow up, never going to understand, be able to make decisions based on information, just as that gives them the best ability to move forward. And in this situation, I believe that's exactly what's happening for too long. We're covering up too many layers of this for too many reasons. And to answer your question, the number one problem would be a diminished capacity of the ability to respect the government, the governing body, and the people that have been put into office. And that's directly what President Reagan had discussed with us, which was the fact that he thought that government wasn't, you know, he thought government now is the problem. It has become the problem. It was the problem. It is the problem. And it's time that the people start being notified of these situations.
But if you forgive me for using this example, tell me if I'm wrong in this example. Let's say grandma and grandpa are long gone. They're passed away. And you find out that grandma had an affair on grandpa, but they stayed married for 60, 70 years. Is it in that context, could you not forgive grandma for having that affair? Or do we take it too lightly under the auspices of time? Do we say to ourselves, you know what? Time heals all wounds. Maybe we can forgive that bit of a...
I agree. If you are prosperous and doing fine, why bring up something that would be hurtful? But I don't believe that that's the case. I think this country is more divided now than it's been in many decades. I think that the wound is never healed. That it's a constant concern or nagging problem that is a catalyst that's led us to this point. And if that's the case, how do you ever have a satisfied person in that? You're going to have to address the concern to move forward. And the problem, one of the biggest problems, is we haven't addressed it. We keep sweeping it under and not openly talking about it. And
so this is just too gaping.
As Reagan said, anything that has to do with Cuba, anything that has to do with the Kennedy brothers' policies and what they were doing and trying to do is considered a national security concern to this day. And again, if we were prosperous and the country was doing fine and we were united on issues and moving forward in directions and the world were looking at us favorably, I say, what's the point? Mm-hmm. But that's not where we are.
Okay. It's just too gaping of a wound to let that time will never heal it. Is that's where you're coming from?
Well, what I'm coming from is it's an issue that is ongoing and is not been put to rest, and people have an open concern ongoing even to this day, and a lot of the concerns that they have ongoing now are also traced back to that period of time. So if we weren't concerned about it, I'd say let it go. But the point of the fact is that we are still very much divided and we're not going in the direction that we should, and we're fighting against each other in such a way that to my point of view, it's one of the biggest national security concerns that this country has. I mean, other countries look at us from the outside and saying, my God, they're divided, they're vulnerable. How are we going to carve up the United States when it falls? Now, I hate to say something like that so bluntly, but at the same time, I think it's a serious issue and we better be aware of it. To be naive of it is foolish.
If we're at this point then where we're so easily carved up, why is now the time to bring out this book? I mean, this would seem like... Well, a time, if we're that vulnerable, do we really want that information out there at this point?
I would think it would be helpful in healing divisions or healing wounds. If I find that that's not the case or I'm doing damage, I would step back and shut down. I'm not in this for fame or anything else. I'm just in this to do what I think is responsible for me to, if I perish tomorrow, if that's my time, mm-hmm. I thought, my God, one of two things is going to happen. I'm either going to leave this to my children, which I don't want to do, or the information dies with me, and that's the end of the line. So I thought, well, that's not a fair thing to do.
Right.
So I put the information in a book. If somebody wants to read the book and they get something positive out of it, or it's going to affect a positive effect, I'll stand there and speak about it like I'm speaking to you today. If it's going to be a negative effect and it's not going to bring about something then in a positive way for this country, for the American public, I'll just stand down. That seems like a logical thing to do.
Understandable.
The Inheritance, Poisoned Fruit of JFK's Assassination. The book releases officially on November 22nd. You can pre-order it by the link that we have on today's program. Christopher Fulton, thank you for coming forth with the truth and sharing your story with us.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
We'll be back again next week with more of the best in Paranormal Talk Radio, plus brand new Theaters of the Mind and Supernatural News, Parashare, and more. For Tim Dennis, I'm Dave Schrader. Have a great week, a happy Thanksgiving, and remember to enjoy the life that you have. Enjoy the friends, the family, the laughter, the love, and take advantage of that. Slow time down this next week and soak it in as much as you possibly can. Have a great week, everyone. Thank you.
This is Julian Edelman from Dudes on Dudes with Gronk and Jules. Sunday mornings, I've got my game day ritual. Coffee, lucky socks, and now new morning Uncrustable sandwiches.
It's all about that 12-gram protein boost with the new Uncrustables Bright-Eyed Berry or Up and Apple flavors.
Bright-Eyed Berry's got a feisty receiver energy.
Up and Apple, your classic do-it-all tight end.
Soft, pillowy, packed with protein, and easy enough for Gronk to grab from the freezer.
Whether you're on the couch, driving to the tailgate, or heading to the locker room, new morning Uncrustable sandwiches are the MVP of snacks.
Your new Sunday kickoff ritual starts here with new morning Uncrustable sandwiches packed with 12 grams of protein.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
At CVS, it matters that we're not just in your community, but that we're part of it. It matters that we're here for you when you need us, day or night. And we want everyone to feel welcomed and rewarded. It matters that CVS is here to fill your prescriptions and here to fill your craving for a tasty and, yeah, healthy snack. At CVS, we're proud to serve your community because we believe where you get your medicine matters. So visit us at CVS.com or just come by our store. We can't wait to meet you. Store hours vary by location.